This is 4:55 on Monday, September 12th. All right, so we are recording. Don't forget to sign in to CLICS. We have some questions a little bit later for that, after we talk about a few things. Note that the second chapter assignment is due tonight at midnight. Many of you have turned it in. Please put your names on the thing that you turn in. All right, that's that's the request. I think I'll go ahead and do those CLICS questions right now. They'll sort of be a refresher and important for what we do later today. So let's go ahead and do that. That's interesting. For some reason, I am not seeing the question up here. Are you seeing the question?
Yeah. Is it the IP network layer protocol one?
Yeah. It's interesting. There we go. So we haven't really talked a whole lot about this. You might be able to infer the answer, or might not, based on what I'm seeing here. Well, it's not very clear, is it? So let's think about it. So IP, the IP protocol stack, IP is the name of the stack. And in that stack, there is a protocol called IP. All right, just to stands for Internet Protocol, the Internet Protocol. And that's the network protocol. And I've said a few things about the kinds of guarantees that you get from that network layer protocol or the protocols that live above it. So what have I said? I've said words like best effort, right? Which means that I put something in and maybe it comes out the other side and maybe it doesn't. Does that sound like it's reliable?
No.
So I think we can get rid of the reliable answers. And then I talked about how we have transport layer protocols above the IP layer, and one of them, UDP, is, well, a datagram protocol. The other one is a TCP protocol, and I said the TCP one has to do a lot of extra work in order to get reliability. Okay? So what do you think the answer is? It's a datagram service and it's best effort. Right? So the answer is B. All right. Okay. So these don't have, you know, if you don't have the answer right off the top of your head, you can often think through what you know and figure out what's going on. All right. Now I think I've given away the answers to most of the next bunch of questions. Not really. Oh, let's go back here. I don't want you to see what everybody else is doing. No, not there. Here. IP network layer protocol delivers to. Thank you. talked about port numbers as not being part of the network protocol, but part of the transport layer protocol. Okay. And port numbers are the thing associated with delivery to applications. So I think we better cross applications off the list. So what about routers? Is there much point in delivering messages to routers? They're going to pass through routers.
Yeah.
Yes, but delivery, you know, you don't say that the letter was delivered to the post office. The letter was delivered to your mailbox, right?
Yeah.
So, hosts, right? That's the goal of the network layer, is delivery of messages to hosts. Yeah.
Send packets back to the clients.
Well, the client will be on a host.
Oh.
Right? The host is the computer. Okay? Don't confuse hosts and servers. Hosts are the endpoints in the network. And in some sense, the whole set of terminology is incestuous, right? Because the hosts are defined as the things that have network addresses.
Yeah, I guess I just thought hosts was
right.
Meant server too.
No, well, it includes servers, but it includes other things too. All right, next one. Well, now it should be, this one should be clear, I hope. What we just said. That's the job of the transport layer protocols. The network layer protocol gets it to the right host, and the transport layer takes over from there and gets it to the right application. All right, given that TCP is a transport layer protocol, what kind of protocol is it? Reliable datagram, best effort datagram, reliable. Okay. I think people need to spend more time with the book. Would be my interpretation. The right answer is C. It's a reliable stream service. It's built over top of the unreliable datagram service provided by IP. But all that extra work goes into making it reliable. This should be review. Or servers.
Right, yeah.
Different. All right, very good. This one seemed. Servers listen passively and are contacted by clients. And as I was mentioning to somebody in the conversation just before class, this term listen is actually the name of one of the system calls that we're going to start talking about later today. All right, but before we can do that, I need to finish talking about DNS. So let's do that. DNR, DNS, yeah. All right. Oh, gee, wrong place. Goodness. Wrong place. Supposed to be on slide 51, maybe? 57? No, 61? 62. All right, so we started to talk about DNS last time, the service within the internet that takes names like mail.w.eu and turns them into IP address numbers because numbers are the way the lower protocols work. It's not centralized because there are so many billions of names that thinking of somebody who could sort of keep all that straight themselves just doesn't make sense. So instead, the so-called namespace is carved up into chunks, and different people and organizations manage different chunks. And some of you may have your own DNS domain manage, mom.carlhauser, dad.carlhauser, person? Whatever. So, how does it work? It's hierarchical, and this notion of hierarchy is something that, as a way to organize big things, is something that you sort of intuitively know, I think. You've talked about trees, right, for keeping things sorted and having bits of a tree be the part of the tree from A to C, and another bit apart from D to F, and so on and so forth. You've seen those search trees. It's sort of like that, except that administratively, we hand off responsibility for different parts of the tree to different organizations. So, at the top of the tree, there are what are called the root DNS servers. And the root domains. And so there are just a relative handful of root domains. At the time the book was written, the handful was smaller than it is now. We, of course, have .com, .org, .edu, .net, but then there's also .us and .biz and all of the different codes, so on and so forth. Those are all so-called top-level domains. And the root servers just tell us where to find the servers for those different domains. Okay? That's what the job of the root server is. The root servers don't even serve those top level domains except to say, you know, that's how you find out about them. Okay? So then let's look at the EDU part of the .edu part of the space. Every university is going to have its own domain servers to serve names within it. But at the level of .edu, there's a server that says WSU here, UW there, Cal Poly there, Stanford there, Cordell there. Okay, so they point off to the places you can find out things about specific universities or colleges. All right, similarly with .com. It says, where do you find out about Yahoo? Where do you find about it? Amazon? Right? And then each of those organizations is responsible for what comes in front of their name. So once we get here, we find out that the WSU name server is at a particular IP address. We can then ask it, where is www.wsu.edu or mail.w.edu. Or even eecs.wsu.edu, which is itself a separate domain, has its own domain name servers. Okay? So it's hierarchical. That's the key word. to look up a name, therefore starts by saying, by asking the root DNS servers, which have well-known addresses, where do I find, say, EDU? Ask EDU, where do I find WSU? Ask WSU, where do I find EDC? Right? So the clients themselves have to go through that process. Now, what do you see as a potential problem with that process? If every name lookup does that process, what happens? Think about a performance issue here. If every name lookup that you do, every time you visit a web page, you go through the process I just described, what's going to happen? Yeah? Why? Yeah. What's going to happen at the root servers? Everybody in the world, every time they look up a name, they go through that process. What happens at the root servers?
Congestion,
right? Enormous congestion. Billions of queries per second directed at the root name servers. Right. So what do we do about that?
Split the load.
Split the load. We could do that. What else?
Cache
the answers. Right? Caching, right? We talked about that before, didn't we? But not for this. Caching is the way that the DNS system avoids causing a lot of traffic to the root DNS servers because the answers that they give don't change. Right? To first approximation. So a client knows that rather than the client sort of asks about the root query, but it gets its answer from a cache. And maybe even when it asks the top level domain, it gets its answer from a cache. Right? And so we don't pester these high level things in the hierarchy a lot with queries whose answers is always the same. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a fairly large cache, though, that the root server has to run?
It isn't the root server that runs the cache. Who runs the cache? The clients run the cache. Things farther down in the hierarchy run the caches. The whole point is to avoid asking the root server the question. The way you do that is by having a closer cache. Cool. Yeah.
So the cache is like our browser cache.
So the caches here can be implemented sort of all along the way, right? So we're going to look. Let's go on and look at how this really looks. I talked about all of those. Let's do something here. Maybe not. Sorry, it's just too big for me to do what I want to do here. Somewhere here.
Yes.
Locally on the machine, I have the names of some DNS servers that I will direct my queries to. And I can cache answers. And in fact, they can cache as answers as well. So when I make a query for a name, what happens, based on the way I've configured my machines, that we actually the query, first of all, to one of these servers at these IP addresses. These happen to be EECS's name servers. The way things are... actually, this is on wireless, so this may be WSU name servers. Anyway, so I make that query to my local DNS server. It doesn't, as it says here, let's go back to here. In some sense, it doesn't belong to the hierarchy because it doesn't necessarily have to have any names that it manages of its own. In our case at WSU, in fact, they do, but it doesn't have to. And so when we make our query, we set it to the local name server, and it will respond based on what it has in its cache, plus any queries that it may do. So here's how it goes. I request the local name server. It looks things up in the root DNS, gets back the answer, then looks things up in the top-level domain, back the answer, looks up things in the so-called authoritative DNS server, the one that is managed by the organization who owns that part of the namespace, called the authoritative DNS server. May have to do that multiple times, and ultimately gives me back an answer. There's another way of doing this in which a recursive query in which the whole query gets delegated to the root DNS, and that is not a good thing. So we don't use those. It's part of the design, but sort of deprecated in use. Oh, that's a good word. I want to talk about that word. The word deprecated means what?
No longer in use.
Still defined, but recommended that you don't use it. Okay? It's not the same word as depreciated. Okay? There's an extra I in the word depreciated, which means something different entirely. So learn that vocabulary. Deprecated is something that you will see up in conversations about computing interfaces all the time, and it always makes me cringe when I see a conversation going on in which the word being used is depreciated, because that's not the right thing. So you guys can be more careful than that. Okay, so we cache the entries. One of the features of DNS that makes caching feasible is that from the outset they knew that they were going to have caching. They knew that they would have to have some way to know when entries that were in the caches were no longer valid, and so they defined in something called the time to live part of an entry that says, after you get hold of this, how long are you allowed to trust it before you ask again? Right? It's a common thing that's seen in sort of network caching protocols. You don't see it in disk and memory caching protocols because they're not distributed, right? You can explicitly send invalidation signals in those sort of local contexts, but in a distributed network context, it becomes very hard to know where things have been cached. And so a technique that's used is to say, as part of acquiring the entry in the first place, be told how long you can expect it to be valid for. And this time to live is part of the reason why when you change the mapping of names by going out and asking your DNS administrator to say, my machine is now on a different IP address, sometimes it takes quite a while, even days, for that to propagate to all the places that the answer may have been cached. Yeah, Colin?
If the parent server is out of date, does that automatically say that all children's servers are out of date too? Is it going to have to go and recache it?
Probably. Probably. That's partly why it takes a while. All right. So there have been proposals for how to be more aggressive about notifying that things are invalid, but the basic mechanism is time to list. So what do you find in DNS? Well, it's essentially a database of records that map different kinds of things to other different kinds of things. And we'll go through that. Yeah, go ahead.
So updates on caches, do they have it staggered in some way so that you don't have an obscene amount of caches being updated at the same time?
Well, so in the distributed DNS, there's no explicit invalidation, right? So things get refreshed when they time out, essentially.
So you could potentially have a large number of caches that are timing out at the same time.
At the same time, but you know, things get spread out, and it seems not to be a problem. But the bigger problem seems to be that the timeouts are too long, and knowledge doesn't flow in a timely way. Okay, so there are records in this database. Think of it as a database, if you're taking a database class, that map from names to values. Okay, they're called resource records, and there are a lot of different types, and these are only some of the very basic ones. The types are somewhat mnemonic as to what they're for. The type A is an address record, and so the name is one of the DNS character string names, and the value is an IP address. An NS record, that stands for name service record, says that that the name is itself the name of a domain, EECS. .wsu.edu, and the thing that I'm going to tell you about it is where to find the name servers for that domain. That's different from just the name of the machine, eecs.wsu.edu. Right? See the difference? One is going to map, the A record will map to an IP address, the NS record will map to name servers that can be used to look up, you know, Hauser's desktop. .eecs.wsu. CNAMEs, aliases, when you have a machine that has multiple names, like clicks.eecs.wsu.edu is actually a CNAME, an alias for something called vm-101.vlan99.eecs. You know, some crazy name that isn't convenient, but this gives you a way of giving a machine multiple names. And the MX record is the record that says, what is the name of the machine that handles email for this domain? So the MX record for EECS, you might expect to say mail.eecs.wsu.edu, but you'd be wrong, because we route our email through a commercial spam filtering service. Right? So instead it points somewhere else, and that service is configured to point to our mail servers. So this is a binary protocol. Remember, the protocols we've looked up to now have been sort of ASCII character-based protocols. This is a binary protocol. Or a mixture of binary and otherwise. A 16-bit number that says what kind of question I'm asking. Some bit flags tell me things like whether this is the question or the answer, whether the server is supposed to do recursion to get the answer. How many questions there are as a 16-bit number, how many answers there are as a 16-bit number, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? And then the questions and answers laid out like so. All right, so we're not going to worry too much about that because the usual way of dealing with protocols, these binary protocols, is to use program libraries like the C library, that have higher level versions of these protocols encoded as APIs, and you use the API to ask the question, and somebody's already written the code that pulls apart these packets. You don't have to do it to get back answers. But if you're looking at what's going on in the network, you need to know about this. Okay. How do entries get into these databases? Well, for a long time, what people did was they edited text files to put names into the databases. How the databases get constructed is actually not part of the DNS specification, because remember, every piece of that hierarchy is owned by somebody, and their only obligation is to answer questions about it. Right? They don't have to share what the file is or anything. They just have to answer questions about what's in their DNS. So how they manage their part of the DNS is entirely up to them. And the big DNS providers now, of course, use databases and transactional semantics to make sure that everything gets done in a consistent way. But it's not part of the protocol. It's outside the protocol. Okay, well, so let's shift gears a little bit and think about this system from the perspective of the bad guys. So this learning to think from the perspective of the bad guys, even when is an important skill for promoting security of computer systems. When you construct something, you need to be thinking about what could somebody do to abuse this system that could cause bad things to happen. And we'll just do that a little bit here with DNS. Well, one abusive thing would be to try to overwhelm the root servers with traffic, blast traffic at them. Hasn't really succeeded to a great extent. The root servers have a very specific role to play in this, and they can put filters on the outside of them to make sure the traffic that shouldn't be getting to them doesn't ever get to them. So that's pretty good. One of the reasons you might ask is, well, why would you want to do this? Why, as a bad guy, would you want to do this? Well, it's along the lines of what happens on the other side of this. If I can keep the correct servers from answering, then maybe I can give my own answers as a bad guy instead. Right? It's sort of a race, right? And if the good guys can be made to be really slow, then the bad guys maybe can give their answers instead. And so what happens if a bad guy is able to redirect bankofamerica.com to his own website? Okay, so we put up the login page, right? And we put in the little box there that says what's your username and what's your password. And okay, now the bad guy has captured your username and password for your bank accounts, and off we go off to the races, as they say. Well, there are more techniques that have been recognized as being necessary to deal with the possibility that that happens. And so today we have things like HTTPS with certificates that say, yes, I'm really at the website that we all agree is the Bank of America website and not at the website of somebody else who's just trying to... But you have to pay attention, right? You have to look at your browser. You have to see that up there in the top line, it's showing you a green secure lock and not showing you something red that's giving alarms that says, this is the Bank of America, but In my humble opinion, Mr. Bank user, that's not Bank of America, right? So, but the reason we have to worry about that is because DNS is sort of fundamentally insecure in this way. It'd be pretty easy to direct somebody to the wrong place. The reason people don't usually do it anymore is because the security of these other security mechanisms makes it much easier to get caught and much harder to succeed. Okay, so we're not going to talk about peer-to-peer applications. You can read the book about that. We'll just skip over that. Race. BitTorrent is a fun protocol to look at, so I recommend you take a look at the write-up in the book about that. Distributed hash tables are a fun thing as well, so there's just not time to go over all of these things. But if you get into doing clever things that involve scalability with thousands of machines that want to talk to each other and share information, BitTorrents and distributed hash tables are clever techniques that have been worked out. Kian?
Have you heard of IPFS, what Jeremy was working on last year?
I vaguely heard of it, but yeah. So the idea is you could store files sort of on other people's machines using distributed hash table sorts of things, yeah. Alright, so, yeah, lots of stuff. Okay, so, race, on to the next topic, which is to learn about programming against the operating system APIs, application program interfaces, that allow programs to use networking services. Now, some of you have 360, and sometimes in 360, Casey has people do some of this. So how many people have done network programming a bit? And how far did you get with it? He gives you most of the code, and so he doesn't really explain what's going on under the covers. So you've sort of seen it at a very high level. Now we're going to go under the covers and explain why things are the way they are. Okay, so we've seen some of this figure before. Remember, we have the protocols implemented in the transport through the physical layer protocols implemented in the operating system. We have this object called a socket that is a data structure, essentially, or a reference to a data structure, that is somehow accessible to both the application process living in user space and the operating system's networking stack. And the processes interact with the stack through the application program interface associated with sockets. And so I will call that API, the socket API, and it is not completely standardized, but it is semantically and mostly syntactically the same between Windows E systems and Unix E systems and Mac E systems, which are essentially Unix E systems. Okay? The general structure of Socket API was developed at the University of California at Berkeley in the 1980s, and it has sort of grown since then, but the fundamental ideas of it are sort of well fixed in stone and well adopted. Microsoft, when they built Windows, you guys are all too young to remember this. When Microsoft built Windows, the first version of Windows was, I think, 1991 or so. And Microsoft didn't believe in the network at that point, in the internet at that point. And so networking was kind of an add-on to Windows. And they started to sort of go off in their own direction, but it wasn't very long before they essentially adopted the same set of system calls for talking to the network that was already used in the Unixy world of the time. Couple of reasons. First of all, everybody already knew, and everybody was a much smaller collection of people than exists today, but everybody already knew that interface. And second of all, a lot of thought had gone into that interface toward getting it right. So it just wasn't profitable to go off and do something else. So today, when I talk about the Unix version of this API, what you're going to see is essentially the same thing that you would see in the Windows socket interface. Things are a little bit different. The Unixy version of it uses essentially file descriptors, small integers to represent sockets. The Windowsy version uses big addresses to represent sockets. And there are other things as well related to controlling some of the operating system specific features of networking, but generally speaking, they're quite similar. Okay, so socket is not a networking protocol. The socket API is an interface, and it's just about how processes interact with networking through the operating system. The protocols, remember, think about the protocols as being communicating with each other. Right? So transport to transport, network to network, link to link, and there will be things in between. Any questions about this? Okay, so guess what? The socket programming interface has different types of sockets for the two kinds of transport, right? There's stream-oriented transport, and there's datagram-oriented transport. And the socket programming interface exposes both of those. Now, unfortunately, I'm a kind of a programming languages guy, and I would like to be able to say, from a programming language perspective of types, those things had different types, right? So that the compiler could tell me whether I'd made a mistake in confusing my socket and stream-oriented query, but that's not the case. These are types in the sense of they're different kinds of things, but the compiler and the language have no idea that that's going on. You have to keep it straight for yourself. Mostly not too hard because you sort of go into one domain or the other and live there for a while. All right. Well, I think I'd better stop at that point. What we're going to do is we're going to do a few more slides out of this set of slides, and then he goes off and does things in Python, whereas I want you to see this stuff from the perspective of C, where it's native. So, with that in mind, go to the resources page for the class on the web page. Guys, go to the resources page for the class, go to the website for the TCP/IP sockets book, and there's some source code there for something called an Echo client and an Echo server. Would behoove you to get your hands on that, download that code, and see if you can make it work. Okay? Things will be more fun if you do that. All right, I will see you on Wednesday.